Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Anna Marie Cox, and I'm not a fan.
Hi, I'm Daniel Dresner, and we've had this conversation before.
Oh, have we, Dan? We certainly have. Welcome to Space the Nation, where we look at science fiction through the lens of post-structural feminism and Tolman's paradox. Today, we'll be talking about The Edge of Tomorrow, available for purchase or rental on most streaming services. Dan, you got it on Amazon.
I did.
On Apple.
Oh, interesting.
There's a variety of choices out there.
Now, I'm curious, because this is a legitimate question. The nice thing about buying it on Amazon is that it also has like the trivia stuff that's associated with it.
So that's true. I just like the way the Apple interface goes. It's
totally get it.
I grew up on it. It's familiar. In the next few weeks, we are going to be talking about Strange New Worlds, the show. We will not be talking about Strange New World.
Right. Although, if anyone wants to fund us to go to a Strange New World to talk about it, that would be amusing. But yeah.
That is not our mission, however.
No, it is not.
Yeah.
No.
We will be talking about Station 11 and the original Jurassic Park, kind of in a nod to the probably very bad Jurassic Park that will be coming out this summer with the lesser Chris. The worst of the Chris's, I think is everyone agrees at this point. That he's the worst, Chris.
But also Jeff Goldblum, to be fair.
Jeff Goldblum, and one of the reasons I wanted to do the original Jurassic Park is the man does not age.
Yeah.
I am looking forward to seeing him being the exact same age in Jurassic Park. We are still figuring out the rest of our summer schedule, but Dan, we have a big idea.
Yes. Well, of course, it's hot sci-fi summer yet again. And I think this hot sci-fi summer will be defined by the 80s. At which point, I would like to apologize to Anna, because multiple times we have talked about how we're going to be doing Thor, Love, and Thunder, and that the defining thing about the trailer is, of course, Sweet Child of Mine by Guns N' Roses, which I kept insisting was a 1990s track, and I was wrong. The people of the Discord have informed me that it is, in fact, a late 80s track. I hereby apologize to all of our patrons, but particularly Anna, for continually correcting her into a mistake. So that is on me.
It's a metaphor, Dan.
But we're definitely going to be doing Highlander. I think I want to do Big Trouble in Little China. We will take other suggestions of awesome 80s.
We only really need one or two more.
Yeah,
maybe
exactly.
Maybe only one more. I think we should do Terminator.
Oh, yeah.
I think we're hitting all the highlights that way.
Yeah.
You know?
All right. And the Terminator, it's a really good film. Yes.
So we are still figuring things out as far as our schedule goes. You should feel free to hop on our Patreon page. And there's a few things you can do there. You can write on the blog post to make suggestions. Mm-hmm. And what else, Dan? What else can they do on that page?
You know, you could choose to become a patron. Or even, in the spirit of Edge of Tomorrow, just repeatedly become a patron. You know, and like ramp up the access that you have and, you know, become a even better patron. And, you know, another great way to support the show, and which costs you absolutely nothing, is to rate and review the show and tell your friends and neighbors.
And I always like to remind people, as Dan mentioned, did you mention the Discord? Because that is where the correction came up.
I briefly referenced the Discord. Yes,
you referenced the Discord. That is Dan's relationship to the Discord. It's a brief reference. But the Discord.
But I do poke in every once in a while.
You do. The Discord is a kind of a Slack channel type thing, if you're unfamiliar with it. Mm-hmm. It is a very cozy little community right now, a very good reflection of the show, I think.
Yes. I agree.
Very diverse group of people and diverse interests, not just science fiction. And I think it's one of the highlights of becoming a patron.
Right. And they all, despite their disparate backgrounds and experiences and worldviews, unite to occasionally make fun of me, which I do appreciate.
Yes. We are thinking of starting a Dan channel. It would be devoted to jokes, information, and gossip and theories. Because there is a current theory that Dan is just an artificial moon.
Right, that's correct. Yes, that I actually that Moonfall actually revealed the secret behind me, which is that I am a megastructure, which, you know.
Well, actually, you certainly are a megastructure. Dan,
I'm trying to cut down on my eating, Anna, okay?
COVID did it, you know, COVID puffed us all up.
That's true.
Dan, but why are we talking about Edge of Tomorrow?
Right, so actually, we should apologize to our patrons, because I think we had not mentioned that we were going to be doing this. In fact, we were supposed to be doing Strange New Worlds this week. But in honor of Memorial Day, and in honor of Tom Cruise doing his part for Memorial Day by suiting up for combat again in Top Gun Maverick, it seemed appropriate to do a Tom Cruise sci-fi war film, a genre that we have not intentionally avoided, and yet here we are. We have never covered it. So let's take that highway to the danger zone and put that song on repeat is all I got to say.
Well, Dan, I was really happy when you suggested this because I somehow missed it. I remember it being in theaters and thinking I should go see that. That's big and dumb. I like big and dumb. But I somehow missed it. And I'm really glad I've seen it. It is a very enjoyable movie. You know, ate popcorn compulsively during the entire thing, which is a little bit because I love popcorn, a little bit because it was like a movie-going experience, really. It was like, it was that kind of movie.
It is. And I will say, this probably is a better movie if you watch it on the big screen. Yeah. There are, particularly, almost all of the film probably looks better on the big screen than it does on the small screen.
Yeah. Dan, we have a section called Chekhov's What's It, where we talk about the something that was introduced early in the film that you kind of know is going to come back later. What is it for you, Dan?
For me, it is Bill Paxton, who plays Sergeant Farrell.
He comes back several times.
He recurs. He is literally a recurring character in this film. And what is impressive to me is that there are a lot of supporting characters in this film. Most of them barely make an impression. What is intriguing to me about Bill Paxton's character is that literally, I think 90% of the screen time he has is having the same conversation over and over and over.
Like, literally the same dialogue.
Literally the same dialogue. You know, mild variations as Tom Cruise is sort of reliving this day over and over and over again. And yet, he is, like, you're transfixed by him. It's just...
Well, he's just very good. He's very magnetic. And it's almost like you want to have someone at a theater school teach this.
Yeah.
Because talk about doing alternate line reads.
Right, exactly. Yes. He does, let me put it this way. The way to put this is Bill Paxton leverages this role. He is not given a ton to work with. He's given some to work with in the script, but he takes that and just spins this confection that you cannot help but watch.
He gives alternate line reads. Like, that's one of the amazing things about the role, is that he's literally saying the same words in every scene, but it's with different emphasis and inflection, different reaction.
Yeah.
It somehow works, and I agree. I wish that more people had more character. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of sad, because Aliens, they do another brief sketch of the platoon.
But it's so much better done. It's so much better done. Like, agreed. Like, you know, we meet that troop, and it takes, maybe 10, 15 minutes tops, and we know who they are.
And you know who else is in that platoon.
I do know. It's, in fact, Bill Paxton. What I did keep thinking about in watching this film, I feel sorry because I believe Bill Paxton passed away almost pretty soon after filming this, is that, you know, I think he and Tom Cruise are roughly the same age. And certainly when you go back to, like, in 1986, Tom Cruise is in Top Gun, Bill Paxton is in Aliens. They seem like roughly the same age. In this film, Bill Paxton unfortunately seems about 15 to 20 years older than Tom Cruise. There's just no other way to put it.
But it is... I almost want to go back and watch Aliens again, maybe. It's like comfort viewing. Because it is such an interesting contrast in the efficiency in which they introduce a bunch of different characters, some of whom have barely any screen time.
And yet are indelible
and all very different. And then there's this cast of characters, which we will not talk about again. Maybe there's one reason to keep talking
about
them
in a little
right
bit,
now.
Yeah.
Is that it's clear that they try and give them each an individual characteristic, but it's mostly like one of them is British.
Like, sort of? It's a little weird. Some of them are. Like, it's a little strange. But Otto, what was your Chekhov's What's It?
It's that thing that Cruise stabs himself with.
Oh, the transponder. I believe it's called the transponder.
Chekhov's transponder. I'm being kind of literal about this. It's a very because it is literally, they say they have this thing that looks like a bunch of needles to be injected in something. Mm-hmm. And there's this tiny bit of dialogue about, that doesn't work, put it away. And I'm like, well, I guess that's going to come up later. Because you don't introduce a piece of technology, talk about it not working, and then just put it to
and
the
side.
And
then just never... And then, like, only in a Simpsons version of this, like, that doesn't work. And we never saw it again.
Never saw it again. Yeah. But speaking of seeing things again.
Yeah.
Dan.
Anna. So, let's get to the story behind the story. So, this is a 2010s Tom Cruise production. I am assuming Christopher McQuarrie was involved in some way, because he seems to be involved at this point in everything that Tom Cruise does. Am I right?
You are correct.
Oh, good.
And I want to talk a little bit about the time loop that is the script development for this movie. But first, Dan, what is the title of this movie?
So, I believe it's Edge of Tomorrow?
It is not.
Oh.
It is Live, Die, Repeat, : Edge of Tomorrow.
I mean, I saw that on the poster, but I don't recall that being the...
It was the tagline.
I thought that was the tagline.
And
it got retitled
for... digital release. I actually was trying to find it on Amazon or whatever, and I kept on pulling up Live, Die, Repeat.
I was thinking,
this must be one of those like knockoff, and they paid to put the placement in the search engine. But no, that is the name of the movie. And I'll just tell you right now, there has been talk of a sequel, and that sequel is entitled Live, Die, Repeat, Repeat.
Are you fucking kidding me? I mean, that sentence might suggest that I think my inner Adorno is coming out and saying he was right.
It's true.
That is so unoriginal. Live, die, repeat, repeat. Come on.
Yep. So I
at least level
this
up.
This is not going to be that interesting, but it is much like my favorite Mr. Showbits. This is a case of repeat until funny. This movie started out as a manga novel called All You Need Is Kill. Published in 2009. It was optioned almost immediately. It was decided by the person that optioned in, a producer named Erwin Stoff, that he was going to get a spec script rather than just pitch it. He got Dante Harper to write the spec script, and that's the guy that wrote Alien Covenant. And it was kicked around Hollywood. It was voted the best unproduced action movie.
Yes.
At the
always
Blacklist.
A distinguished honor, yes.
Yeah, well, it is, actually. It's always
No, it is, actually.
So Warner Brothers bought it. They hired Joby Harold to do
a
rewrite.
Wrote John Wick 3, I believe, right?
Yep.
Yes, okay.
Then they hired Roberto Orci and Alex Kurtzman to do a rewrite.
Those are the Star Trek guys, right?
Like they are, point. And also a Mission Impossible movie, which
there you go.
Intended to like comfort Tom Cruise, right? So then Doug Liman was hired to direct. Great. Okay. He throws out most of the script.
Okay, yeah, sure.
And he gives it to the Butterworth brothers who...
Okay,
have...
now I think you're just making shit up. Let's be clear about this.
Who barely have any screenplays to their name, by the way. I've been trying to give some place people in context, but... So he gives it to Jez and John Henry Butterworth, real people.
Okay.
They do a rewrite. And then it goes to Simon Kinberg.
The guy from the X-Men films.
Okay, that's right.
Yeah. All right.
And then we're not done.
No.
They're about to shoot. It's eight weeks before shooting. And McQuarrie comes on board.
Enter McQuarrie. Got it.
And Tom Cruise were working on the Jack Reacher movie. That's how they became connected. Cruise got a hold of the script. There's more. I'm trying to make this repeat until funny, but it's actually just kind of, it's just weird. Like, I have never seen this. Like, I do a lot of story behind the story for this. This is the most rewrites I've ever seen.
I was going to say, like, ever. We've talked about other classics that, like, had implausible origin stories because there were multiple screenwriters, but this is easily the most I can recall.
This is nuts. So Cruise gets a hold of it, and he says he wants it to be more comedic. It's too dark.
Okay.
So McQuarrie makes it more comedic. He, swear to God, this was said in interviews, McQuarrie and Cruise base all the deaths that Tom Cruise has on Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
They actually started principal photography for this movie with a no ending.
Just like Casablanca. Yeah. I mean, again.
But eventually came up with the ending that exists, which is, you know, I mean...
It's fine.
The thing is, we'll with time travel movies yeah. is like, it's hard to come up with a satisfying ending for most yeah. time travel movies. So yeah. we'll talk about it. But I will also say that it did get very good reviews. Mm-hmm. It has a 91% from critics. Huge success at the box office. Budget of $178 million. It grossed $370 million. And the last thing I'm going to say mm-hmm. is I get a lot of this stuff from Wikipedia.
Yes.
No, you would guess that. I'm not right. ashamed.
No, there's no shame in this. Yeah.
Right. At the end of every Wikipedia entry for a movie, there's always like, you might also want to see, you know, this movie or this thing is also cited in these other things.
Right.
This is what is at the end of this movie. A list of films based on manga. That makes sense.
Totally fair. Right. Yeah.
A list of films featuring time loops. That's also something you might be interested
Absolutely
in.
Absolutely appropriate. Yeah.
And then it's a list of films featuring powered exoskeletons, which is just super specific.
I would say, are there any beyond aliens in this? I mean, I'm sure there are.
I did clearly, look. But, there's a list. It's more than two.
Okay, good.
Then there's a list of science fiction films from the 2010s.
Okay.
Good. And then it is a variation on, Dan, you do military history. Have you heard of this book?
No. The Defense of Duffer's Drift, yes. A 1904 short book with a similar premise.
I will save this for the newsletter, but basically this was a World War One, like, what is it called? It's an instructional manual for different kinds of warfare.
Okay, but I'm just going to point out this was written prior to World War One, 1904.
Oh, sorry, yes, a decade before. Yeah, I guess it's actually, was it like, sorry, yes.
Yeah.
I was used in World War One.
Okay.
Although, since it is about time travel, who knows, right?
That, yes. Okay. Totally fair. Totally
Maybe
fair.
The author went to World War One, saw how bad it was going, decided the troops needed to learn these different battle strategies.
Yeah.
But it is the same plot, like because he keeps waking up on the same day, Duffer.
Oh wow.
Or whatever his name is, keeps waking up on the same day and trying different tactics. Hmm. Dan, the most recent iteration of this was written by the Rand Corporation in 2009, I think. And you can find it online.
Okay, our conspiracy theorist listeners are going to go off the charts as a result of this. This is great. I love it.
Like, it's been rewritten because I guess this idea that you fight the same battle over and over, but there's some kind of narrative attached to it.
There you go.
I don't know. Anyway, I found that interesting.
That is interesting. And I do kind of want to read the story now.
I skimmed it.
Yeah.
It is very much intended for people who are going to go into battle. Like, it's very,
that's
like...
unfortunate. Okay.
It's like, I imagine it, it's sort of like, well, the original East is a little bit like a film strip sort of feel to it. Like, now we're going into battle. Everyone get your hat on straight. You know, like, sort of like if you were watching in health class or something. Only it's about war.
Oh, no, the slide is now misaligned
with the
audio, which I'm sorry, you're mentioning film strips. I always was amazed at that iron law that it didn't matter how obvious it was. Inevitably, at some point, whoever was running the film strip would get misaligned with the audio.
We didn't do a lot of film strips. I actually do remember them. The people listening to this podcast are a lot of Gen Xers, so they're going to remember them too.
Yeah, they're going to like film strips. We're catering to our base here.
All right, but we should move on.
We should.
For some reason, we've already been talking about this movie for 20 minutes. So let's keep going.
All right, let's speed on to the plot. Let's go to Act One. Jerry Maguire goes to war. An asteroid containing a species known as the Mimics crash lands in Europe and starts to overrun the continent. The United Defense Forces fall back to the UK, but then win a victory at Verdun, led by Sergeant Rita Vertasky, a.k.a. the Angel of Verdun, a.k.a. Full Metal Bitch. This encourages the UDF to launch an invasion of the continent, codenamed in no way ominously Operation Downfall. Meet Major William Cage, a U.S. Army public affairs officer who has been the hype man for the war, praising the funky new equipment that ostensibly enables even an untrained soldier to kill mimics. Cage meets General Brigham, who is in charge of the UDF, in London the day before the invasion. Brigham must have seen the Americanization of Emily because he wants Cage to be in on the first wave as a PR ploy. He all, by the way, expects minimal resistance on the beaches, so it's not terrifically life-threatening. Cage does not like this plan and tries to blackmail Brigham. He then tries to flee HQ, but is knocked unconscious.
Okay, Dan, few things.
Yeah.
I had not seen this movie, so I thought there were a few different ways it could go
okay.
at this point.
Yeah.
Part of me thought maybe that new equipment actually sucks. And this is a story about someone.
It's really a story about the military industrial complex.
Yes, exactly. That is not what it's about. And the other thing that occurred to me is you're in the general's position. Do you want a reluctant hype man as your propagandist? Like, as soon as he says no, I think I'd be like, all right, I guess, you know, because you don't want someone who's just going to be terrified and also doesn't want to be there.
Yeah, that part was not terrifically plausible. Okay. I do agree with that. Although I have to say, I went along for the ride. Have you seen The Americanization of Emily, by the way?
I have not.
Okay, this is a non-sci-fi movie, but it might be the most cynical World War II movie ever made, with James Garner and Julie Andrews. It is a lovely film involving a cynical aide who, for some reason, is dispatched to Omaha Beach. It's quite something. But it has to consciously echo that, because otherwise there would be no way you would do that. But I grant you, that part of the plot does not entirely track. But let's get on to the rest of the plot.
He should still get in trouble, perhaps. But yeah. I think... And
oh,
I guess,
he does get into trouble.
Yeah,
I think the answer is what happens is by him doing what he does, he's still going to be on the first wave. There's just no one filming him now.
Right. That's true. That's true.
So that part made sense. What I agree with you is that if he had expressed any sort of recalcitrance, it is questionable why the general would have said, no, you're the one who's got to do this, as opposed to, I don't know, just focusing on an eager grunt, which would have
been... Or just putting a fucking
sense.
GoPro on somebody's head, you
there
know? Anyway.
Anywho, Cage wakes up in Heathrow, FOB, Forward Operating Base, and learns from Master Sergeant Farrell that he has been stripped of rank, branded a deserter, and reassigned to the Misfit J Squad to go in on the first wave. Shockingly, downfall proves to be a disaster, as the mimics seem to be almost anticipating their invasion. As J-Squad dies, Cage uses a claymore mine to kill a large blue mimic, but is mortally wounded by the explosion. As he's dying, he's covered in the alien's blood, and so, therefore, Cage jolts awake again to find himself back at Heathrow 24 hours earlier, feeling an awful lot like Bill Murray in Groundhog Day. Anna, what is it about Tom Cruise that makes his best performances the ones in which he plays a total weasel?
It's tempting to say that maybe those are the ones that require the least acting for him.
Oh, that's mean.
But that's mean.
I
don't think that's even true, necessarily.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if it's because his asshole roles are in some ways more subtle than his good guy roles.
You know what it is? So a couple things. I think it's because when he tries to be a good guy, I think Tom Cruise is actually an underrated actor in some
ways. Yeah, I think he's a good actor.
But when it comes to him trying to be good, there's almost like a tick he does where it's like he's trying to make the effort, and he's trying to make the audience see that he's making the effort. And he does that in, like, Jerry Maguire, for example, when he gives that climactic speech. It's like he's clearly like, can you see me doing this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when he's a weasel...
There's less effort involved. And it's not because
he's
an asshole. But
right, it's not because... But it's because he knows that that's the best way to appear being a weasel, I think. But, like, yeah, like, whether it's, you know, Jerry Maguire at the start, or Collateral, or Magnolia, he is fantastic in these roles, and it's fascinating.
I would say, in Magnolia, I think that's one of the best performances of, like...
Yeah.
In modern film. I mean, that's says a lot, but it is an astounding performance.
Yeah. But, like, and that's another example where he, again, to be fair, he's never always the asshole, except in Collateral,
right.
I guess. But by and large, you know, he always starts off being the weasel and then slowly becomes a good person. And you can see, as he becomes a good person, he's, like, almost, like, shaking with the effort to try to make that physical.
You're right. I mean, it's not that it's not believable that he becomes a good person. It's just, it does feel different. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did enjoy this movie in part because Tom Cruise is also, he's a good comedic actor, doesn't always get a chance.
Oh, yeah, he's a very good comedic actor. Yeah.
To do that. And I mean, there's always a comedy in his action films.
Yeah.
But this, you know, I think I kind of rolled my eyes when I heard the Wile E. Coyote, you know, comparison. But it actually works.
Yes, it does.
And most of him dying are comedic scenes. Most scenes of him dying are comedic scenes.
And,
he has to play them as comedy.
Right, yeah.
And
he's
very good.
Yes. No, in some ways, it's the loosest part of the film, weirdly. And, like, it's the best part. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Act 2. You Can't Handle the Truth About Time. So Cage keeps reliving the events of the day, dying and resetting. He tries to convince J-Squad what is happening to him, but they just tape his mouth shut. After a couple of iterations of this, he saves Vertaski on the beach, demonstrating that he knows what is happening. Vertaski recognizes what Cage is doing and tells him to find her when he resets the day. Cage does this, and Vertaski explains that this had happened to her in the past. She takes him to see Dr. Carter, a disgraced mimic expert, and they exposit what is happening. So, apparently the mimics operate as a single consciousness, with millions of drones, a few alphas, and a single omega that runs the show. The alphas function sort of like nerve endings. When an alpha is killed, the omega can reset the day and learn from its mistakes. However, when the alpha bled onto Cage, it transferred the resetting power to him, just as it had done with Rita previously. So, every time Cage dies, he resets the day and can learn from it. The Omega will try to find him, however, leading to visions of where the Omega is. Vertaski wants him to keep resetting until he sees where the Omega is, and then they can kill it. Cage will keep this power until the Omega kills him, or if, when injured, he gets a blood transfusion. Anna, did I get all that exposition correct?
I think so. The part that I wasn't sure about was, so, but it's different when the Omega kills him and he dies?
I would assume so, but like, actually, you're right. That is technically not in the film, but I'm assuming that the point is that the Omega, if it ever gets its hands on Cage, can actually destroy him. But you're right. That's assumed by me.
Yeah, I have some questions about the time travel stuff. We will not indulge them here.
Right.
It would take us.
The one thing I would add, the one thing I would add is that apparently what happened to Rita is the reason that she was so good at Verdun was that she had the same experience.
I wish they'd made that more clear, because I thought it would be a funny little, you know, turn if she wasn't actually a newbie, right? Because in the hype that he is doing for her.
Yeah.
It's always like, it was her first battle. She was barely trained.
Right, which is correct from his perspective, since,
But it would have been funny for it to turn out that she had the same situation, right?
She did have the same situation.
Which we can assume, but it's never made even a little bit, like, the film never nods at that.
It's sort of rushed through. I think basically what Rita says is that she had the exact same experience, which is why she got really good at being a soldier. But then the question was, well, then why did we win at Verdun? Once she lost her power, and her explanation is they wanted us to win, so we would launch this invasion, kill us.
Yeah, but they never...
They rushed through it once, and it was not entirely clear.
Right, because it would have been more... I think it would have been cool, like, just for Cage to realize that he had been hyping this woman who got to train over and over and over.
Right, you're right. In other words, that he had realized that even the assholery that he had done in terms of like prompting this was at least based, at least as far as he was concerned, on the truth, when in fact it turns out it wasn't.
Yes. That would have been a little turn that I would have appreciated.
Okay.
Let's move on.
Vertaski trains Cage how to fight, and what follows is an excellent montage of Cage dying in myriad ways through training exercises. Eventually, Cage does have a vision of the Omega being holed up in a German dam. And now that Cage has envisioned where the Omega is, Vertaski and Cage then try to get the dam during the invasion. This leads to yet another excellent montage of Vertaski and Cage dying on the beach and inland, making minimal progress. Anna, what is it about seeing a montage of Tom Cruise dying that makes it so satisfying? Because it is undeniably satisfying, and any review of this film has commented on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that this is sort of repeating what we said before, but number one, Cruise is clearly having a good time.
Yeah.
There is a lightness to this part of the movie that keeps it from being oppressive, you know, that keeps it from being depressing. Like, in the moment, it should actually be really depressing to them, right?
Right.
Like, to keep having to die. Mm-hmm. But in a weird way, because there are zero stakes, right? It actually gets funnier, because comedy usually needs stakes.
Yeah.
But so it's very broad physical comedy.
No, it's true. And so what was the funniest death for you? Because, like, I know what it was for me.
Well, I actually liked it every time he was like, no, don't, no, it's just a flesh wound, you know?
Right, no, that was the funniest one is where he's like, I think he said, no, I just broke my leg this time. It's fine. It's all right, fine. And, like, he surrenders at the end and Rita just kills him. So, like, that was... And I think you're right, it's a lightness. And I think the other aspect of this, and this is the meta aspect of this film, is that you know, Tom Cruise is one of the biggest stars in the world. He is someone who is, I believe, over 60 and looks 40 at best.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's a lot of reasons for many people to despise him. And this is the one of those rare moments where I think Tom Cruise is, like, willing to have fun with himself.
Yeah.
And so everyone gets to enjoy Tom Cruise dying. It's like, you know, that's the way it works.
I will just also add that Scientologists believe in reincarnation. So, not a big deal for him. Perhaps.
So the stakes are low for him, too. That's fair.
Yes.
All right, let's move on to Act 3. I feel the need to bleed. Getting bored with the death dynamic, Cage decides, fuck it, deserts, and heads to London during one of these weeks.
This confused me at first.
Yes?
Like, because I thought it was like a flashback or something, right? Because like, but...
They're all flashbacks in some ways.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But actually, I thought it was, I mean, it's not played for laughs. But then when I saw it, I was like, oh, yeah, like that is something you could do. And
right.
Good idea.
Yes. He's in London in a pub drinking and realizes that not only is the invasion going to fail, but the mimics will actually invade the UK at the same time. With renewed Tom Cruise-like determination, Cage and Vertaski keep heading for the dam. The problem is that every time Vertaski dies. So, and finally Cage fesses this up to Vertaski, and Vertaski nonetheless gets into the helicopter and tries to get there anyway. Cage finally decides not to bother Rita and head to the dam on his own. He succeeds, but finds no Omega there. It's a trap. Instead, an Alpha tries to get his blood, but Cage drowns himself before that happens. I would add that was the one death that I actually found horrifying. Because, like, you know, to drown has got to be one of the worst forms.
It is.
It was the one time, like, in all of this where it was like, oh, God, that was an awful
way. Not that we can know for sure, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it does seem like one of the worst ways to die.
Yes.
I just want to point out that I think she had a point that he should just keep going.
She was completely right.
And
yes. No. Let's be very clear. I mean, one of the things about this film is
if he had a chance to kill the monster, right?
Yeah.
Like it one death versus this is calculus people make all the time. This is maybe another indication he's not a soldier, I guess.
Well, let me put it this way. When we talk about Rita training Cage, Rita's training Cage in two ways. One spoken and one unspoken. The spoken way in which she's training Cage is to teach him how to fight. But really what Rita is also teaching Cage is why they're fighting and what it means to actually try to win. So, yeah, I mean, if Cage had actually been rational, the way to think about it was, well, okay, I've got to go on my own. If I fail, we just reset and it'll be fine.
And
if I win, the war wins. But I will say this is, and again, I will give Tom Cruise credit as an actor. What I think was happening, and this is actually relatively speaking subtle as this film goes, is that it's not that Cage didn't want Rita to die. I mean, I think he recognized the logic of what I said. I think it was that seeing Rita die over and over and over and over and over again was, in fact, beginning to weigh on him, I guess would be the way to put it.
I agree. I mean, my nitpick is less about the movie logic than it is about, like, the character's logic.
Yeah.
Is to say, I think you're exactly right. Like, within the framework of the movie recognizes that she's right.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Cruise's character reluctantly recognizes that she's right.
Yeah.
And she knows she's right. And it is an interesting scene.
Mm-hmm.
We will talk more later about the degree to which there's a romance in this movie. I appreciated that it seemed real platonic at this point.
Yes, I agree. And again, I'm beginning to appreciate this more with more loud sci-fi films that we watch. The other nice thing about that scene is that it was quiet. It was a lovely little interlude, you know, and then revs up again. It was almost like listening to a piece of concert music where, like, there's just a brief lull and then it just supercharges. And that lull made it nicer.
And there's a trope that you referred to in your introduction about, have we had this conversation before, that recurs throughout the movie.
Yeah.
And there's a few different places where he's trying to hide the fact that they've had this conversation before.
That was a clever trope. Or that was a clever moment in the script where when Rita realizes, wait, we're having this lovely moment, and he knows we're having this lovely moment, or he knows this is going to happen.
That was also kind of the most Groundhog Day moment, I thought, because it's the place, and no shade on the movie about this, but it's the place where you see the character growing and taking advantage of his situation to become a better person.
Yes.
Rather than just do whatever he wants, right?
Yeah. Anyway, he and Rita deduce that the visions that they were experiencing are actually fake-outs trying to lure Cage to be captured. So, the only way to locate the Omega now is to use one of Carter's prototype gizmos on Cage. The trouble is that the UDF has locked the transponder up in a safe in Whitehall for super vague reasons. So, Cage and Vertaski's new mission is to infiltrate UDF HQ at Whitehall and get General Brigham to give it to them. After many tries, they finally succeed and use the gizmo on Cage, and he sees the Omega holed up in a garage underneath the Louvre, and as any alien, you know, visiting the planet would go. Some sci-fi films are very detailed and grounded in their world building. Others are a bit more hand-wavy. And I don't think there's a right way or wrong way of doing it, but I do think it matters to be consistent. And the one thing I will, like, that keeps nagging at me about Edge of Tomorrow is that it clearly tried to be grounded in some ways, but there's a lot of hand-waving in other places, yes?
So there's one specific thing that bugged me.
Yeah.
Which is the way that Cage establishes his credibility to people when he's like, I'm a time traveler, you know, is to tell them two ways. One is to pre-react to things that they're going to do. Okay, cool.
That makes sense.
The other thing is to tell them details about themselves. But like in the scene with the general.
Right.
There's the part where he's like, your secretaries are going to come in, tell her, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then he goes into like, and you've assigned her son to Australia where he won't get hurt, you know? And I'm like, wait a minute, how would that, wait, did that come up in a previous conversation? No, that wouldn't have come up in a previous conversation. Like, did he use one of his days to research the general's secretary?
Right.
And then there's another scene where he tells one of the J Troop people your second grade teacher's name and like some other bit of detail. How did that come up? Like, did he use another day to like go back and research this member of J Troop's childhood?
You know, this might be where Groundhog Day did a better job with this premise than Edge of Tomorrow. Because with Groundhog Day, you see these similar things where like he knows what's going to happen and occasionally like, you know, saves the kid falling from the tree. But also he winds up knowing everything about everyone.
Right. But you see him discovering those things.
Right. And that's the problem. The problem with this film is that clearly, and I get why they did this, is that you don't see a lot of the loops that he experiences.
Yeah, fine. Yeah.
And I can imagine that he might have picked up some of this stuff. But part of the problem, which we've talked about, is that J Troop is so unmemorable that we don't believe that he would remember them is, I think, one of the issues.
Well, and also there's the one with the general secretary really bugged me because that would just never come up. Like, it would never come up that the general, like...
Right, because who's going to say that? The secretary's not going to know. The general, who is a taciturn sort, is certainly not going to volunteer that information. Indeed, the best acting that Brendan Gleeson does in this entire film, it's not a large role, but the best acting he does is simply him staring at Cage whenever Cage says ridiculous shit to him.
Yeah.
You know, it's like he's got this completely unblinking demeanor that makes it clear, I am not buying a word of what you're saying. It was very well done.
Yeah. And it's just, I mean, the movie could have benefited from just a few...
Another screenwriter?
Oh my God. You know what you just made me think? There probably were scenes where this happened.
Yeah, it could have been. Like, to be fair, like, there's so much stitching together. Like, one wonders if... Like,
it is amazing. I mean, it is amazing that the movie turned out as well as it did.
Right. Like, to be clear, we're nitpicking at this, but this is on the whole a pretty good film. Like, it's an eminently watchable film.
Yeah. We're definitely nitpicking. Yeah. It's just... And I also think that if I saw this in a theater, I might not have been as aware of some of the flaws.
Yeah.
Because it just, you know, let it wash over me.
Right.
Although sometimes I can do both as like with Batman.
Yes. Or even Doctor Strange. Yes. Fair enough. All right. Let's close with Act 4. Sometimes you just have to say, what the fuck? Let's crash the Louvre.
You are really like digging into some deep cruise cuts here. I appreciate that.
It just seemed appropriate.
Yeah.
Just when Cage discovers that they know where the Omega is, they get into a car accident and Cage is given a transfusion while in custody, which means that he has lost his power.
And I would like to point out.
Yep.
This, it's one of the things they make very clear is that you need to kill yourself rather than get injured. Right.
Right.
And also they become really good at
killing
themselves, optimizing the reset.
Right. Rita, I would say it's slightly variable. Rita knows this cold. Yeah. And so, like, there's a previous loop where they manage to get the doohickey, but they aren't able to use it. The moment they realize they're surrounded, Rita responds by immediately killing Cage.
Yeah.
And that's not what happens in this time.
She should have done that here.
There,
like,
you go.
It would have, he would have eliminated the risk of him getting injured after having gained the intel.
You know, you're right. And what's even more so is that now that I think about it, not only should she have killed him, the benefit of killing him was is that in the next iteration, they didn't have to do any of that.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. Exactly. He would have come back with the
intel.
He
would have come back, would have told Rita, we've done this before. He's at the Louvre.
Or the Omega's at the Louvre.
Let's just go. Yeah, you know what? You're actually right. That's a good point. Excellent point. You're a better Rita, Anna. You know, that's all I got to say. Anywho. So Cage has been given a transfusion while in custody, which means that he has lost his power. Rita escapes and frees Cage. They realize the only way to stop Downfall from being a disaster is to attack the Louvre before it is launched.
And here is also where the timeline gets a little exaggerated. I mean, no, I mean, not the timeline in terms of, like, they're on the right timeline,
yeah,
but this is not taking place within 24 hours, realistically.
Depends on how long he was in, like,
unconscious
for. Anyway, the point is, they can't do it alone, so Cage uses his godlike knowledge of J-Squad, which, as Anna has pointed out, is somewhat dubious, to convince them into coming along. They fly a transport to Paris.
They're all red shirts anyway.
Exactly. They fly a transport to Paris, but are shot down just short of the Louvre. The rest of J-Squad redshirt themselves in a sacrifice for Cage and Vertaski to get to the Louvre. Once inside, Vertaski sacrifices herself to distract the Alpha guarding the Omega. Cage dives into the water where the Omega is, but is stabbed by the Alpha. But not before he pulls all the pins on the grenades and drops the belt in the Omega. As they both die, however, the Omega's blood gets into Cage. He then wakes up again, but this time several hours prior to all his previous loops. He's still a major, and his attack must have succeeded because the UDF had registered an energy surge from Paris, and now the mimics have lost the will to fight. It looks like the UDF, the Russians, and the Chinese will be able to retake the European continent, and there will be no international relations problems after that, ever.
I thought of you, of course, a few times when it showed, like, all the happy cooperation among the different nations. I know, knowing that's very realistic.
Yes, exactly. Anna, in the last loop, in the attack on the Louvre, Rita kisses Cage. And as much as I am a fan of pretty people getting it on screen, I wasn't completely sold on that decision. Do you think Cage and Rita get together in the new future?
I hope not.
Yeah.
You know, like, it would have been, up until that point, it's actually pretty realistic that they're not in love, actually.
Yeah. Like, I think he's smitten with her, I think would be one.
But yeah, like, they actually don't have a lot of chemistry.
No, they don't. Yeah.
And it is believable that this is not going to be a consummated affection.
Yes. No, exactly. It's believable that Tom Cruise is smitten with her. It's also believable because of the way Emily Blunt plays that character that is not going anywhere.
And it would have been cool to have it not go anywhere.
Yeah, yeah, I
agree. To just have it be like a major action film with no romance.
Right.
That the primary relationship is one where of respect.
To be fair, there's barely a romance. There's literally one kiss.
I mean, it sort of just it spoils, doesn't totally spoil, but I remember I was like, really, you know?
No,
like,
I think it would have been better without the kiss. I agree with you on that. I think it was unnecessary, and yeah, I think it would have been better.
I also want to say something about the ending, which is,
yes,
as I mentioned, they started shooting the script without an ending. Or maybe, you know what I should have said? They started shooting the script with about 8 different endings.
Probably, apparently. Yes.
One from each iteration, right?
I want to know what the different endings are. They should have had a montage with all the endings.
Yeah, because it is hard to end time travel.
Right.
You know, movies. So the one they went with, McQuarrie described it, described the way he made the choice to do that was that all comedies reset. In classical comedy, you end up in the situation that you had before. Like,
yes, fair enough.
And that's true. Mm-hmm. I almost don't want to nitpick because, again, you paint yourself into a corner with the time travel narrative, right? So this is as good as any. Okay, fine.
The way I would describe it is this is, again, like a very good Marvel movie in that the first 2/3 are really, really good and the final act is somewhat problematic. It's not bad. It's just, you know, it's a thing.
Yeah, well, I was thinking, Dan.
Yes, Anna?
Is there IR in this movie?
Anna, just listen. It's going to sound ridiculous at first, but the longer I talk, the more rational the IR is going to appear. So let's start with the ridiculous part, which is the global response to the Mimic invasion. So there's lots of vague references in the early and ending stages of the film that there's some sort of global coalition involving Russia, China, and what is called the UDF, the United Defense Forces. So, like, my first question is, did NATO sue so that they would not get mentioned in this film? Because, like, I don't understand why NATO would not specifically play a role. That's the obvious security alliance that would handle an invasion of Europe. It's literally pre-existing. I don't know why they kept saying UDF rather than NATO. That made no sense to me whatsoever.
Well, okay, I'm just, as the less studied person here... UDF makes sense because it's a very quick way of saying the whole globe is here.
Fair enough. Yes.
Like, except, it's like, not just NATO. Because if they threw NATO in, I think people would be like, oh, that's Europe. Right?
But it was Europe. Like, they, it
right.
Was
no, right. But
the,
no. We see very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
People of different color and different nationalities marching out together.
Yeah. I guess, let me put it this way. Part of the problem was the film was actually a little casual with this because at times you thought that UDF was like the European coalition doing this. And like, were the Russians and Chinese members of the UDF or were they allied with the UDF? It didn't, you know, it wasn't clear.
Oh, see, I assume the reason they called it the UDF is that it's not NATO.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough.
So and also, Russia and China.
By the way, maybe the other reason they called
it... Or in this future, they're part of NATO.
Who knows? Maybe part of the reason...
NATO becomes pointless.
Part of the reason they might have called it UDF is that because not even NATO has mixed units like J-Squad. Like, I kept thinking, in what universe do you have, like, British and U.S. soldiers, like, at the squad level? That does not happen. It's never happened. I don't know why they did it.
Did this come up with Aliens? It came up in another movie.
It was the Lawrence Fishburne and Sam Neill one, Event Horizon. It was Event Horizon.
Yes,
you're right. So in that sense, you know, that's a good Event Horizon reference. I like that. Yeah. Now, the somewhat more interesting question is Vertasky's assertion, which she says during the exposition dump, that an enemy that knows the future can't lose. This certainly seems banal and obvious, because it's certainly true that an enemy that is completely, you know, sure about what the future is likely to win. And the classic example of this, by the way, is Israel launching a surprise offensive during the Six-Day War because they were fully aware that Egypt and Syria were going to attack them and so took them by surprise. And yet, there are so many instances in which actors with precise intel about future attacks had leaders who refused to believe or could not be bothered to respond to that knowledge. So in fact, it turns out an enemy that knows the future can lose. And there are plenty of examples of this. Indeed, there are recent examples of this. France and Germany, prior to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, did not think that Russia was actually going to invade Ukraine. They thought it was all an exercise in coercive bargaining. Indeed, Germany was caught so by surprise that Germany's intelligence chief was caught in Kiev and had to be, like, specially airlifted out.
Dan?
Yes?
I'm going to pick a nit.
Okay. Pick away.
Which is... You're describing a situation in which people refuse to believe they know the future.
Yes.
Which is different than knowing the future.
Okay. That's
if I told you that, I don't know, I'm trying to think, like, bats are going to invade your house. Let's use to keep it and not a war metaphor.
The hell did I do to you, Anna? Why are you giving me this nightmare scenario? No.
Right. Yes. So they're going to, Dan, they're going to. They're to invade. And you're like, that's preposterous. Right. I don't believe you.
Yes.
It's not the same as you knowing the future. You think you know the future. You think that bats will not invade.
Right.
Just saying.
Let me put it this way. So,
because if you have certain knowledge of the future,
mm-hmm.
I know there are lots of examples of people just fucking up and being mm-hmm. warned. A pandemic, for instance, on the horizon.
Oh,
I think people talked about that at one point.
Who would have thought that? Yes.
But they think the problem is they think they know the future. The problem is given information about mm-hmm. the future, which we now know to be right because everything's played out the way that it played out.
Mm-hmm.
They should have taken that advice.
So,
but they thought they knew the future.
Right. Okay, here's the way I will parse this out, which is there are two ways you can think about knowledge.
You're making a very good point about the fallibility of right. intelligence.
But part of
but
it...
But I'm just saying you can't squish the time travel part in.
But here's where I will squish the time travel. We often talk about knowledge being both observable and verifiable.
Right.
So observable knowledge means that someone can actually witness the knowledge and know what is happening. Verifiable means they can show it to others as undeniably true.
Okay.
And the problem with time travel, much like intelligence, is that in time travel in this instance is observable by Cage and Vertaski, but it is not verifiable.
But
and
Vertaski so is correct when she says this enemy knows the future and it can't lose. Because this
that
enemy,
is correct, yes.
The mimics don't
are a
just
single
have,
consciousness.
Are a single consciousness,
right.
And they have observed the future.
That is fair. Yes, and I will simply point out that what Vertaski would also have to acknowledge is that an enemy that contains multiple independent decision makers, when dealing with this, it is entirely possible that the leader of the enemy might be told this information and refuse to believe it.
I will point out a micro example that shows the difference here.
Okay.
Because think of the times in the movie
where
someone tries to attack Tom Cruise.
Right.
He knows the future.
Yes, he does.
So he just dodges every punch. He can't lose. Yeah. He is an enemy that knows the future, and so he can't lose.
Okay, so let me put it this way. Emily Blunt's assertion. Okay, fine. No, that's a good way of putting it. I guess the response is that Rita Vertaski is therefore correct. An enemy that knows the future can't lose.
Yes.
It is, even in the world of time travel, there is almost never a situation where the enemy actually does know the future, unless you're talking about a single consciousness. And in our world of international relations...
Either Mimic or Tom Cruise.
Right. And in our world of international relations, to the extent that we can know the future through intelligence, it's a question of whether leaders actually believe the intelligence. And never, ever underestimate the ability of an actor to refuse to believe what is manifestly true. And furthermore, the smarter the person, often the more adept they are at rationalizing their disbelief.
That is also true for conspiracy theories, by the way.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Yes. Yeah. So that's all I'm saying.
The smarter someone is, the harder it is to get them to change their mind, even if their belief system is based on incorrect...
Or absurd premises.
Or absurd, yeah.
Yeah.
This just occurred to me, and I feel like the people who listen to this podcast know this, but I've been watching a lot of these documentaries about cults or about scams and stuff, and... Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, there's this sort of idea. I mean, my ex-husband used to always say I'd never fall for that. And I think one of the reasons people like these is that, I wouldn't fall for that. I'd see right through that. But the truth is, I think these things are fascinating because I might fall for that.
Yes. We all say we would never fall for it until maybe there's one that we, you know what it is? It's not a conspiracy theory. Maybe there really are UFOs out there.
Maybe
it turns out that there was a lab leak that causes COVID or what have you. It becomes
there's
really interesting that way.
Some bearded guy in the sky controlling every move of everyone who had a son who died and then lived again.
Oh, I thought you were going to go the Scientology route, but the fair enough. Yes.
So the Scientology one is true.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Good. So Anna, I have a question.
Mm-hmm. Damn.
And you, we've had this conversation before, but I will ask it again. Is there a critique of capitalism in this film?
Dan, it was poker night. Or maybe a bachelor party. But I wasn't quite up to wringing a critique of capitalism out of this movie. There's not a lot. The market doesn't really make an appearance. If it had been a really interesting critique of the military-industrial complex, like I thought it might have been for a second there.
But it wasn't. Yeah.
It was not. The way that it has a critique of capitalism is, of course, as a metaphor for the way that capitalism forces us all into time loops.
Oh, well done.
In which we repeatedly sacrifice our bodies and our labor only to wake up the next day and do it all over again, powerless to change the outcome. Unless, of course, we're willing to organize.
Well said, Anna. Well said.
Thank you. I also, now that you mentioned the Adorno piece of Live, Die, Repeat, Repeat, which is a terrible, terrible name for a movie.
It's just a horrible title.
By the way, it keeps on getting announced and then not getting made, so maybe there's hope. Which is also kind
of
funny.
Maybe we're reliving the announcement again.
Or
and again,
maybe
again, yeah.
It needs as many screenwriters as the first one.
Yes.
But of course, the other kind of metaphor in here is Adorno's idea that we just need the familiar in order to, like, keep going. That we. But here the familiar is violent. I like it. I like my other metaphor better.
Good.
All right.
Oh wait. Wait.
Ding.
What's that? Anna, do you hear it? It's the mimics.
It's, oh my God, the blood.
The blood.
Have we had welcome this conversation?
Welcome to Space the Nation. No, just kidding.
We both had the same idea.
Yeah, there we go.
Dan, this is the part of the show where we talk about the things we didn't get a chance to talk about before. Mm. What do you got?
Not a ton, but a few small things. First, there is some wonderful moments of dialogue in this film, and I think my favorite...
There ought to be, given the number of screenwriters involved.
Yes. But my favorite is when, after, you know, Rita and Carter do the entire exposition dump, Cage responds by saying, "This is a terrific presentation, by the way." And I did, like, there's not a ton of specificity, but I love the idea of the ad guy saying, "This is a terrific presentation." You know, like, yeah. it was just hysterical.
And sincere. He's just like, you know.
And then during the sort of quiet farmhouse scene, you know, Rita at one point says to him, "All right, 10 minutes and then I'm killing you," which was just always a nice line. I just want to salute Emily Blunt's trainer because there is, I mean this sincerely, like, you see a couple of shots of her and she has clearly put in the work. And I think I remember reading stories at the time about the sort of, you know, physical training she had to do to be sufficiently buffed out for this role. And it was convincing.
I wonder if she and John Krasinski, like, if he was getting in shape for Jack Ryan and she's
getting
in shape for this. They're, like, working out together.
Yeah. I would like to think that they would alternate. Like, I would assume that, like, two actors that are simultaneously, like, having to eat only, like, chicken breasts.
You're right. Yeah.
And so forth. That would just be, like, they would be the grumpiest fucking people on the planet.
Especially they have kids, right? So
yeah, exactly.
You need one parent who is functional, like, who wasn't surviving on, like, 800 calories a day.
Exactly. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
And then finally, I will say, like, it wasn't exactly a critique of the military-industrial complex, but, like, one of the things I did like about the film is that I think we're supposed to think the tech is actually clunky and kludgy. You know, like, the suits that they're wearing don't work very well, and we see them breaking down multiple times. And, you know, like, yeah, we see them occasionally used well also, but, like, I thought it was supposed to be...
From my reading?
Not great. Yes?
I think that's somewhat accidental.
Oh, really? Okay, well, it worked. It was a happy accident, is the way I will put it.
It is funny. I don't think they meant it to be a critique of any kind, I think. I think they just wanted it to look lived in, because we all know that sci-fi has to look lived in now.
That's true, yes. What do you got, Anna?
So it's at the very beginning during a good montage scene. Not as good as Reign of Fire, but a good...
Reign of Fire will always have the best opening montage.
The opening news montage. Let's call it, be specific. Mm-hmm. It has a news montage. There is a point at which we see Cage doing the rounds on cable.
Yeah.
What they show is my friend Jake Tapper, his show, and my friend Olivier Knox, very clearly not sitting next to Tom Cruise.
Oh, is it that bad? Okay.
It is the green screen. Like, the green screen, you can't actually see the green. But you pretty much. And I was like, if Olivier had ever sat next to Tom Cruise, I would know about it. Like... Probably Jake, too. Although Jake Jake is at a point in his career. He may have sat next to Tom Cruise at some point.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Olivier is now a head of chief political editor at Washington Post. But he's been around DC for a long time. He's a great guy. Mm-hmm. But also, I know him well enough that it would come up if he had ever sat next to Tom Cruise.
Yes.
But I also want to break in to tell my story of being...
Oh, do tell.
...doing a cameo as a talking head on cable news.
Oh, when were you... Okay, so do tell.
Have you ever heard of the movie Downsizing, Dan?
This is the one with Matt Damon?
Yep.
Yes, I've heard of it. I have not seen it. But...
Dan, I am in the news montage.
You are?
I am.
I'm going to have to watch it now. Yeah. Okay, yes.
Yeah, out of the blue, apparently the director, Alexander Payne...
Who I love.
He's amazing. He actually, well, there's a story about kind of how he got in touch with me, but he personally wanted me to be a talking head.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah.
That's flattering, Anna.
And so I got to fly to Montreal or Toronto.
Toronto. Yeah.
Which a lot of filming done up there. And
including The Expanse. Yeah.
Get all gussied up. Ooh. Have full make. It was actually, unfortunately, it was the last day of filming. So no one was there except for me and Roland Martin, who was the other talking head.
Talking head, right.
For the scene. So, but it was fun. Costuming, wardrobe, makeup. And the gossip I can pass along
yes.
is that for some reason, I guess because we're talking about Matt Damon, I said something about Ben Affleck and all the makeup ladies like simultaneously like sighed and rolled their eyes. And I was like, oh. What? They're just like, oh, he's notorious. Because of his back tattoo.
Oh, dear.
He is notorious among Hollywood makeup people because every time he's in a movie that doesn't feature a back tattoo,
it's got to be covered up.
It's got to be completely covered up.
Yeah.
And so it's an extra, like, they told me how long it takes, but it's hours to, like, cover it up.
You know, I actually wondered about that because, like, they're occasionally, like, they're act like The Rock. Most of the time you see The Rock, he's got a clear tattoo and it's not covered up. And I kept wondering, are there, actors or actresses where the tattoos are covered up?
This is one. Okay. And if you think about it, there are a lot of movies he's in where there's not a Phoenix tattoo on his back.
That's a good point. Yes.
They also went out of their way to say how great Matt Damon is. He is charming and personable and respectful to everyone and remembers people's names and birthdays and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, good for him.
Other thing that was funny is it was on a big lot in Toronto and everything looks the same, like all the sound stages. They look like huge barns, right? Like, or if you've ever seen the Warner Brothers intro where they do the wavy old timey.
Yeah.
It's all like that. There's all these huge metal barns. They all look exactly alike. At one point, like, I had to go get something. Like, I don't remember, but I had to leave the studio, soundstage.
The soundstage.
Soundstage. And then I got lost coming back because you would get lost too. Right? And I didn't realize I was lost. I thought I knew exactly where I was. And at one point, I get to the soundstage, I open it up, and I boldly stride.
Oh, no.
And it was the set of The Expanse, Dan.
I like how you brought that home, Anna. You brought that back to
They were not currently moment. Filming.
Oh, okay.
And I give myself some credit for the comedy I did purely for my own enjoyment at this moment, which is that I walked backwards out.
That's a good story.
And then what happened is I tweeted about it, and the guys that write The Expanse guys, James and
Ty
got back to me and were like, "Oh, you should have said hi. We're big fans." Da, 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 da.
Ty and Daniel.
Yeah, Ty and Daniel. So it's James S.A. Corey, who's not real.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that is my story. I will not give anything away about the actual news montage.
Okay.
Because there's some comedy to it that
I'm looking forward to watching.
Best not to explain. The other funny thing about it is that I get residuals. And also I'm not a member of SAG, but I get a lot of mail and email reminding me I can join SAG.
Awesome.
But I got a residual check for $12 like just the other day. When it came out, the residual checks were never huge, but
they were maybe more figures than two.
More figures than two. Yes.
Fair enough. Yes.
So that is my story. And also I will say I don't think Olivier and Jake had the same experience because I think they just pulled CNN footage.
Yeah, that's probably what they did.
That is a big piece of debris, but I'm glad I got
that
to tell
was
the
a
story.
Pretty large debris piece.
It was like an asteroid,
but worth it. But worth it.
I want to reiterate the awesomeness of Bill Paxton, who does have a great line that's also kind of sus, which is, "I'm not American. I'm from Kentucky." Which I'm like, funny line. Maybe don't want to know the full historical context about why he put it that way.
Let's put it this way: it's less funny now, unfortunately. Yes. But yes, but he does. But it again, credit to Bill Paxton; he sells it, and it's just so well done. Yes.
And I was going to bring up some problems I had with the time travel piece, but you know what, Dan? I'm going to leave that to the Discord because it's not actually fun, really.
Yeah.
To pick apart a time travel paradox.
It's not.
Because they exist. They're paradoxes, yes. Right? Yeah. It's like describing your dream to someone.
Well, the way, let me put it this way. I think I would close by saying this. The thing about this movie is that it is less a sci-fi film than it is a war film.
Yes.
And that's the issue. The issue is the war stuff is actually quite good. Like, the battles on the beaches are extremely well done.
I have a debris field piece. Bing, 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 bing.
Yeah.
Dan.
Yes?
Their approach to that beach, number one, why are they using infantry? We've talked about this before.
Yeah.
Infantry, probably pretty useless, unless we'd gotten some hand wave about, like, why we have to fight them mano a mano.
Actually, if you have to control territory, infantry does matter. This is one of the things that people are realizing in the war in Ukraine. But keep going.
Okay. Yes. All right. Well, yeah. I thought of you, and I thought, is infantry really the right, you know,
more interesting is why they had to use the helicopter gunships, which made it, yeah.
Line dropping down.
Yes.
That's a recipe for disaster. That's like...
Not only that, but like one of the other issues is that you see them drop. They've got a tether connected.
That's what I'm saying. Line dropping
to the
down.
Helicopter. Yeah. Like, and if like that copter is destroyed, they're all buying it. And like that was the part. Yes.
You know what? Like in Normandy, it's a good idea. Get your ships up there and have people run down. Like that is the way to go. Right. Like it is the first thing I thought of. It's like this is really stupid invasion. Like they are doing this in a way that like of course they're going to lose.
How dare you disgrace the memory of Operation Downfall like that, Anna?
The other thing I thought is maybe they really want to telegraph like what a bad idea it is.
I think that's pretty much what they. I think that's kind of what they were going for. Yes, I agree.
All right. So now that's all the debris. It is a war movie, although the war parts. Some of them are suspect. Some of the actual war parts.
Fair enough.
Are suspect. Yes. But what are we doing next, Dan?
Next, we are doing Strange New Worlds, and then I believe Station 11, and then after that, the original Jurassic Park.
I will remind you that if you aren't already a patron, please become a patron. We do this mainly for fun, and because it started during the pandemic, and it has enabled us to, you know, both be friends with each other and make new friends.
Right.
And it is worth doing no matter whether you're a patron or not, but it does help us out tremendously if you can become a patron.
I'm not going to lie. It makes us feel a little better to know there are more patrons. So yeah.
And but, we're so close to 250, Dan.
That's true. And when we get to 250, we will do another patrons only episode on a topic chosen by the patrons. It doesn't even have to be sci-fi.
Yeah. We were talking about this. Yeah. I'm going to let everybody in the Discord know if you want to hear us talk about terms of endearment, we will do it.
Yes, fair enough.
We will do it.
Fair enough.
Flash dance? I don't
Absolutely.
Know.
Absolutely. Totally.
I'm just trying to come up with movies that would not in any way like
you know, scenes from a marriage.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
The color series, like the color trilogy. You know?
Oh, there we go. Oh yeah, red, white, and blue. Yeah. Before sunrise, before sunset, before midnight. Yeah, we can do any of them.
Okay, well that's it for now. Until next time.
Keep this channel open for more.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.